good evening and welcome to Wednesday's Late Debate. Joining us tonight, we have Barry Cowan, Fianna Fáil TD for Laois Offaly, Michael Fitzmaurice, Independent TD for Roscommon Galway, Dennis Nocton, Independent TD for Roscommon Galway and Chair of the Parliamentary Committee on Social Protection, Community and Rural Development and the Islands, Gráinne E.A., Brexit guru with thejournal.ie. Now, we want to hear from you, so please do get in touch. You can text us on 51551, email latedebate at rte.ie or tweet to at latedebate. RTE. Now, Boris Johnson has been breaking bread with the, or as we understand it, eating scallops and turbot with the European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen for over 3 hours. We're standing by for news of a breakthrough. No white smoke from there yet. Earlier, Boris Johnson told the House of Commons that he still believes a trade deal can be done, but he said it would not be on terms that would require the UK to keep EU rules and standards.
Our friends in the EU are currently insisting that if they pass a new law in the future with which we in this country do not comply or don't follow suit, then they want the automatic right, Mr. Speaker, to punish us and to retaliate. And secondly, they're saying that the UK should be the only country in the world not to have sovereign control over its fishing waters. And I don't believe, Mr. Speaker, that those are terms that any Prime Minister of this country should accept.
And that was Boris Johnson in the House of Commons earlier today. I want to go over now to Tony Connolly, the RTE correspondent, who's standing by in Brussels. Tony, it's been a long day there. Any sense at all of how that dinner meeting has gone?
Hi, Katie. Not a huge amount, really. We've just had the menu, and of course we've all been talking about how fish was going to be in the menu in this dinner, but it is literally fish on the menu. So they're having pumpkin soup with scallops for starters, and then steamed turbot with mash and wasabi for the main course.
Oh, lovely.
So that's all the information that's filtered out so far. We can read into that what we want.
Is it seen as deliberate,
Tony?
There were
scallop wars between... Of course it is deliberate, but there were scallop wars between French and British fishermen in 2018. That's one thing. And I think in a no-deal situation, the tariff on turbot would be about 20%. So lots of hidden messaging in there by the chef, no doubt. But anyway, they have lots more beyond fisheries to talk about, as we know.
And like, is there anything leaking out of that encounter at all as of yet?
Nothing yet. I mean, the only thing that's leaking out is that they're still talking. And when they finish talking, they will probably issue a joint statement. Now, in the room, we have obviously Boris Johnson and Ursula von der Leyen and the two chief negotiators, Michel Barnier and David Frost. And then they would have their own key advisors with them. So, you know, they're going to be sitting around and trying to look at the fundamental issues that confront them. The two negotiators have drawn up a list, an overview of the obstacles and what's been tried, what's worked, what hasn't worked. And I guess they're just going to look at it again through much more high-level political eyes. And I suppose if from an EU point of view, this would be a chance for the EU to say to Boris Johnson, look, this is our price for entering the single market, and we think it's a fair price. Boris Johnson will obviously repeat the lines about British sovereignty and independence. But just to pick up on what he said in the House of Commons this morning, this idea that Britain would be punished if it didn't follow the same new legislation that the EU follows. I mean, the flip side of that is that if the EU introduces a new set of regulations, say for the Green Deal to reach climate neutrality by 2050, and that means European companies have a more onerous set of obligations to abide by, if the UK doesn't follow suit in some shape or form, then you could say that automatically gives UK companies an advantage over European ones because they won't be complying with the same regulations. So there's always two ways to look at this interplay between sovereignty and the price you pay to access the single market.
How long was this dinner meeting expected to go on? I'm just wondering, is it a good sign that we still don't have any word from it at 10 past 10?
No, there was no particular cutoff point, and you know the issues are very serious. And if they are going to do some major furniture shifting on the politics of this, you know, it will take some time. And I mean, ultimately, if there is to be a deal, it will involve highly creative crafting of language that will give both sides sufficient legal reassurance and rhetorical reassurance that they can both go ahead into the future feeling that it's a fair relationship, but also that they can both sell it to their own constituencies. And remember, Boris Johnson has to sell, is there really to defend the interests of the hardcore of the Conservative Party who want this pure sovereignty approach. Ursula von der Leyen is talking on behalf of 27 separate governments who have their own defensive interests on Brexit. So you can see that that kind of conversation could drag on well past the steamed turbot.
You could indeed. Micheál Martin, the Taoiseach here, was quite downbeat in his assessment in the Dáil today. And is there any sense of the mood music there being equally downbeat at this stage?
Well, it was certainly downbeat over the weekend and in the early part of this week. I mean, you basically had a phone call between Johnson and von der Leyen about 10 days ago, and then you had another phone call last weekend. And in between times, things just seemed to get worse in the negotiations. Both sides accused the other of adding last minute and unacceptable demands on the other. And Michel Barnier gave a briefing on Monday morning and again on Tuesday morning to EU foreign European affairs ministers, where he said, look, this is tilting towards no deal. We're just not getting anywhere. But there's a bit of a simplistic approach, if you like, which says if the EU moves on fish, then the UK will move on the level playing field. But I don't think it's that simple. But there are people who think, Look, you know, if there is a significant gesture from one side, then that could encourage the other side to move, and you could get this virtuous momentum. But you know, you wouldn't bet the house on it.
You wouldn't bet the house on it, indeed. Tony, I let you go. Many, many thanks for joining us. As I say, at the end of a long day for you there, and looks like there'll be a few more long days in this yet. That's Tony Connolly, our Europe editor, there in Brussels with that very latest on Brexit. And if anything does come out of that meeting, we'll try and get back to Brussels. But thank you for that, Tony, at this stage. Gráinne, if I can ask you, listening to Tony's assessment of the situation there, would you be betting your house on a deal at this stage?
I find it hard looking at all the conditions and all the details around the deal, why we wouldn't get one. At the end of the day, as hard as the final issues have been, and remember fisheries, the level playing field and governance have been problems from the start, from when they started negotiating in March. They still have I think it was over 95% or 97% deal that is done, agreed and drafted. Both regions, the EU and the UK, are facing into a recession. Dominic Cummings is out of Downing Street. Joe Biden is President of the United States, President-elect of the United States. I don't see any advantage in not striking a deal and in not making
Are you making the mistake there, though, Gráinne, applying rationale to what has been essentially a rational project from many of our perspectives from the very beginning?
Something else that the Taoiseach has said earlier in the week as well is that Boris Johnson is more like the Liberal mayor he was than the Conservative Brexiteer he became. That's actually quite crucial to this as well. I think Boris Johnson as a leader has changed from when he first came in and said, let's get Brexit done. And remember that vote that he rode into the huge majority into the House of Commons, that vote was based on people being sick of Brexit. So on that basis, they should, it is in his interest to get a deal done so people don't have to keep talking about it all the time.
Indeed, Michael, I'm thinking particularly about farmers out there, and anybody and so many other ancillary jobs connected to farming and the agri sector. I guess it's torture, really, watching this, you know, slow car crash, if that's what it turns out to be. What's your sense?
Yeah, I was just listening to Tony Connolly, and he was telling us the lovely lunch they had tonight, or the lovely dinner they had tonight. I'm damn sure there's a lot of farmers down the country, you know, especially in the beef sector and the dairy sector, that couldn't care less what they were eating, that want them to get a deal done. There is serious consequences, especially for the likes of the beef sector. And look, regardless of whether there's a deal done or not, there's going to be disruption. And the one worrying part, I would, you know, if you listen to the British MPs, they keep telling us that there's 100 billion being imported from the EU, and the tariffs that they would get in would more than compensate for what they'd have to put out. Boris Johnson's speech today in the House of Commons, that it's basically the fish to take back their waters, and in relation to the level playing field, didn't seem to be like a guy that was going over this evening to Brussels to do a deal, to be quite honest about it. But I think that heads have to be knocked together. I think for the betterment of, you know, I just hate to think the consequences for the small rural areas right around this country if we hit a hard Brexit. We have to be ready that if that happens, to press the button that will put in the, basically the likes of aids to storage for the beef, that will put in the mechanisms and the funding to make sure that rural Ireland is protected.
I just see a text in here. This issue of common standards has been at the heart of Brexit since the start. The EU will not back down. Boris says he won't back down. End of any deal. Dennis Nocton.
Well, look, Brexit is happening on the 1st of January, regardless. And there is market disruption as a result of that. Anyway, we've seen what's happening in terms of the beef trade.
Nothing like what we could be facing.
Absolutely.
if there's no trade deal.
But I think it's important that businesses out there realise that there is going to be a dramatic change from the 1st of January, regardless of what type of a deal will be done. I believe a deal will be done. But coming back to the point you make, Katie, I think this idea of equivalence is going to be the key issue in terms of standards across the English Channel. And in fact, we've already had this debate in the Dáil in terms of the trade deal that we've done with the South America in terms of equivalence of standards. And it may hopefully bring home to many of the players at European level and decision makers, you know, that the issue of equivalence has big implications, and trade needs to be tied in with similar standards, not just in terms of the UK deal, but the North American deal and the South American deal. Like, if you look at the issue of beef, for example, like at the moment, there's huge pressure to reduce beef production here in Ireland. And that's going to be replaced with beef coming from Brazil, where the carbon footprint of that is 35
because
times
they're in feedlots,
year.
And exactly. It's a completely different product, actually. Barry Cowan, I think anyone looking at the Taoiseach earlier describing what he felt was where we were at now, the precipice of a no deal. It's a very, very serious situation.
It is extremely serious, as the two previous speakers have alluded to, and the implications for our own economy is grave and would be grave. And we've yet to see sight of what our reaction to that scenario would be and how we would safeguard as best we could against the gravity of that situation. I do, however, believe, as Grainne has said, that you're 95% of the way there. I think there's a lot of brickmanship on the part of both parties, I'd imagine. And I'd be confident that a deal can be struck, because the prospect of anything other than that is too grave, for us, as I referred to, but for the UK too.
Sorry to cut across to you, Barry Cowan, but I'm getting breaking news that meeting has in fact broken up in Brussels, and we can go straight away over to our Europe editor again, Tony Connolly. Tony, is there news?
The news is, Katie, that the meeting has ended. Boris Johnson's cortege has just left the Berlaymont building, the European Commission headquarters. So the meeting has ended after 2.5 hours or so, and no statement yet. But obviously, we'll keep an eye on that, and I'll file anything that we have on that as soon as I get it.
Okay, great. Okay, we might be back to you again, but we'll certainly bring you any scrap at all of information or indication that came out of that meeting as soon as we get it. Thanks for that, Tony. Go back as you were. We will leave that there now because
I think one other thing that needs to be noted.
Yes, Michael.
If there was a hard Brexit, there's 100,000 tons of beef going from the UK into Europe. There is also 250,000 tons with the Mercosur deal, as Dennis has pointed out, and Barry. And the EU seem to be gone into a scenario that they want to get beef somewhere else to say that we're all this great, clean, green economy. And I think that we have to have a bit of realisation in this. And if the Brits don't do the deal, well, obviously, that 100,000 should be kept in their own country. They'll badly need it, from what I see. And the other deals with other countries needs to be looked at and stopped straight away, because we have to protect. If Europe is all for one and we're together, this is the opportunity for them to show it.
Okay. Okay, as I say, we leave that there, but we will return to it if we get any indication at all of how that meeting went this evening. But I want to move on now because the Shannon Bridge power station in County Offaly will stop feeding the national grid on Friday next, while the Loughrea power plant in Lanesborough in County Roscommon, in operation now since 1958. In County Longford.
Yeah.
I do beg your pardon. Lanesborough, of course, is in County Longford. Will cease production the following Friday. It's the end of an era for the Midlands, which has hosted 10 peat burning stations since the early 50s. Generating power has recession-proofed this region. But the over-reliance on one sector has left it very vulnerable to now, as climate change rendered peat burning obsolete. The double shutdown is a massive blow, with an estimated loss of over 1,400 jobs. So this is why we have assembled the three of the Midlands' finest public representatives, because it really is, isn't it, a really, really big moment for this part of the country, for the Midlands. Dennis Nocton.
Yes, it is. 70 years we've had power generation from peat in the Midlands. It has sustained generations of families right across the Midland counties, from East Galway and Roscommon right over to Barry's neck of the woods in Laois and Offaly. And, you know, I've described this as the equivalent of Google deciding to pull out of the city of Dublin. That's the scale of the decision here and the implications that it has for the local economy. And that's why we need to do everything possible to look at alternative employment for the Bord na Móna staff. And we've had some news on that in the last week in terms of access to a €106 million fund for bog rehabilitation. But we've got no clarity as to the terms and conditions for the workers and the seasonal workers.
350 jobs will be supported by that fund.
Yes, and that will probably help the permanent workers in Bord na Móna. But a lot of the seasonal workers have received no clarity as to whether there will be employment available for them. And then there's the bigger issue of what do you do with the two power stations?
Indeed, yeah. Barry, can I ask you about that fund first and foremost? It's for bog restoration.
So yeah, it's
an environmental project.
For re-wetting. But it's incumbent, as Dennis said, on a programme being laid before the communities and the region as to which bogs have been selected for re-wetting. Then they need to say what bogs have been selected for alternative power generation, whether it be solar or wind or whatever it might be. And that also has to tie into the various proposals emanating from the Just Transition Commissioner, in line with local authorities, in line with the funding from central government and indeed the EU coal and now peat regions in transition fund. And all that has to be married together with the support and of the communities as well. And, you know, there may be a consultation process in relation to the re-wetting programme to ensure that those within the immediate vicinity are not adversely affected by it. And that's necessary too.
Okay,
strands have to come together, and they are coming together. And this is happening at a pace. The pace of the acceleration of decarbonisation hasn't been the same pace at which the response should have been. We're trying to play catch up, and
people who are not familiar with the story, it's like they originally the idea
2030
was 2030,
so,
and this was going to start in 2018, so it was going to be 12
years. 6 months later, 6 months passed.
Yeah, so the Just Transition period has been truncated hugely, massively.
Yeah, and it was initially, of course, the impact was on those that lost their jobs, whether to be full-time or part-time or seasonal workers. the implications for their families, for their communities, the loss of rates to local authorities in the case of Offaly and Longford. 20% of their income is impacted by the loss of these facilities. Huge knock-on impact on services and goods provided by local authorities.
But isn't the real huge issue as well that these aren't just any old jobs that are going? Like, some of those ESB jobs would have been really, really well paid. A lot of the Bord na Mona jobs would have been well paid during the peak season.
Well paid and very well trained and highly skilled. And,
do we have any idea what fitters, these replacement jobs are going to be?
Well, I mean, first and foremost, one had to identify a revenue source that could be targeted and placed at the behest of these communities and this region. And that's why I was very adamant that the carbon tax, at least initially, the recent increase that you had, that be ring-fenced. And I think it's incumbent on government to ensure that the hypothecation of the entire revenue presently available from carbon tax is targeted at this area and other areas thereafter to help and assist those communities that are most impacted by this acceleration of decarbonisation. And the Just Commissioner, Kieran Mulvey, to be fair, working together with the Midlands Just Transition team based in the four or five counties which is affected, have done great work in identifying areas and means by which any targeting of funding can help and assist. And we've seen not only the funding in relation to Bord na Mona last week, but we've seen the first tranche of funding of the Just Transition targeting communities, targeting tourism projects and various community projects and commercial projects that have potential to realise jobs and can help and assist the communities respond to this.
Okay, I'm going to bring you in. I just want to tell listeners again, we're seeing Reuters are reporting that von der Leyen and Boris Johnson agreed over dinner that by Sunday a firm decision should be taken about the future of the talks. I don't know whether we should take that as a good or a bad sign.
They both save face, for the moment.
Exactly. That's another day's work, literally. Michael,
in relation to Bord na Mona, first of all, I think we need
to just locally on the ground, what's the feeling?
Well, I think we need to put things into perspective, Katie. We are getting rid of peat in this country, while at the same time there's boats coming from Estonia and Latvia now, bringing peat to Ireland. It's like bringing water to the well. Coming into ports in this country for the horticulture sector. Also, the 75 million a year was coming in, say, from Kildare down to Roscommon, Galway, Barry's area, Tipperary, all that area, out of wages and the people. You have to think of the engineering companies, the shops, all the other parts of it that weren't direct, was coming in every year to that year. That's gone now to about 11 to 12 million. So that's a fair drop. In relation to the 100 million, and all monies are welcome in fairness, the 100 million is over 5 years. That's the first thing. That's 20 million a year. And we would have worked with the national parks in re-wetting some of the designated bogs. And 5 million was 17 diggers for 240 days, along with the engineer that you needed or the engineers to draw it up and maybe one person with it. So you're looking at 85 diggers round for 240 days. That's what 20 million is to spend it in rewetting. The other thing you have to be careful of that you
work... So what are you saying? Is that...
I think it's a real stretch to be talking about 350 jobs. Great if they do that, but...
But they'll be very poorly paid jobs, of it, presumably.
What I've seen of it over the last number of years, I don't think that that's there. Also on top of that, we have got to make sure, and I've always said, and I'm sure the guys agree with me, if you look at La Masse, what was done in Shannon years ago when you needed to bring investment into the area, the likes of an economic strategic zone in all of that area to give the carrot to businesses to set up in that area, because there is huge, and I think we should pay tribute to the workers of both Bord na Mona and the ESB down through the years for what they've done. But I also think, I don't actually agree with getting rid of power stations. I think like Arigna Fuels or whatever.
We couldn't keep burning.
But listen, to bear me out. They're talking about knocking them to comply, right? And I think we could be looking at the likes of a tourism incentive to be able to bring a historical route or a historical, bring tours to it to show that may help in different areas. I think that it will need a lot of money to get people back up working again. I think it can be done, but I do think that we have to make sure that we give that incentive and call that area an economic strategic zone to make sure that we get work into it.
Yeah, Barry.
Yeah, Michael is right. And the Just Transition Commissioner has his plan. The EU coal regions and peat regions in transition will also have a plan, and the government have a plan, and Bord na Mon have a plan. And it's essential that those plans are finalised and put to work. Because
but given that the
Dennis said previously, we're always a report away from action.
I was going to say that, but I mean, given that those two power stations got now, there will be families facing into a very cold Christmas because they did not expect to have their employment taken from them.
There's an attitude, to be fair, amongst the general publics and communities in the region that they are up for it and they do understand what's expected of them in relation to this acceleration process. But they want to see something in return and they want to see real commitments. And last week, in my opinion, was the first week that real commitments became a reality when you had 49 groups in the region approved for second stage funding amounted to 30 million, 10 million in Offaly, and I can't say what they were elsewhere. But that was the first real sign. And that's, you know, people don't mind paying a carbon tax if they can see a return on it. And I was adamant, as others in other public representatives in the area are, that that's ring-fenced and that's targeted. Now, there is provision for poverty-proofing as well, and there's a retrofitting programme that has been initiated with local authorities, which can create economies of scale to broaden that. But as Michael alluded to as well, one thing that hasn't yet happened, and we saw it at the time of the SACs and the taking of bogs then, that there was a programme put in place to help and assist people transition away from that source of heat. That's not happening presently, and it has to happen, because a retrofit of a house might cost 40 or 50,000 euro. We don't have, and people don't have, the capacity to meet that demand. But they should be in a position where there are 5 or 6,000 to change the source of heat that they have available to them. And some programme aligned with ESB, aligned with Bord Gáis, or with the state to help and assist people make that transition where economies of scales can be created. In relation to the plants themselves and their closure this week and next week, it is ridiculous in the extreme that the conditions associated with their permission presently means that they have to be decommissioned. It is incumbent on the minister and the government now to respond to the calls that we and others have made as public representatives to ensure that they're given maybe to the local authorities so they can apply for retention to keep them in situ for another year, to allow an open competition whereby communities or the commercial sector might make applications to be adjudicated on by the commissioner that can return investment, that can return jobs, that can return something from those that can't be done if they're decommissioned.
Dennis, can I just ask you before you get going, and I'll let you come back.
before
you wind up there, I spent some time driving around during the European elections, driving around the Midlands and talking to various people in small towns and trying to get a feel for the feeling and the place. And the feeling that I got really strongly from the Midlands was we've been forgotten about here. We've been left behind. These are the flyover states. This idea that
there's potential.
We haven't had enough heft at the cabinet table. Now, of course, you had your moment there, and Barry, you had an even shorter moment there. But that they haven't had somebody shouting loud enough for them.
And I think that there is a point in relation to that. And, you know, when Project Ireland 2040 was published, it specifically designated Athlone as a growth centre and a hub and spoke model to develop not just Athlone, but the towns of Mullingar, Tullamore, Banlasloe, Roscommon and Longford as well. When I was there, we brought gas to Ballymahon, which allows for the extension onto Longford and potentially maybe even to Lanesborough to convert that into gas. Things did happen and a lot of work. Like, I was the one that took the decision to close the two peat fire power stations. The decision was that we would cease peat harvesting in 2026, cease burning peat in 2027, and those two power stations have a lifespan of another 10 years. Now, I think it would be absolutely a wanton waste of public money, about 176 million euro, if we were to demolish these two plants now, which Ciarán Mulvey, the government's own Just Transition Commissioner, has said are in pristine condition.
But the issue, of course, isn't, people don't understand, it's a, the ESPCA, it's a planning issue. That
you can always go for it.
Absolutely, yes. There is a planning condition there that they must demolish it within 2 years of completing its use as a power plant. But they can go back and look for planning permission, again, in relation to it. And there are possibilities there of those plants being used for power generation in the future. Ciarán Mulvey has also highlighted the need that we need to see some flexibility in relation to state aid investment in some of the projects that Barry spoke about and the money that's there. But communities don't have the 15% and don't have the mechanism to raise that 15% now. And, you know, local authorities and state agencies need to come on board. And just coming back to Michael's point regarding the economic strategic zone, both this year and last year in the finance bill, I specifically looked for the counties, first of all, to be designated with special tax designation. And when the Minister for Finance wouldn't play ball on that, we designated the two sites where the two power plants are at the moment and the 20 Borden and Mona work sites. So very focused, targeted investment on those. And that's the type of thing that needs to happen and needs to happen
quickly.
Did
you waste too much time on the biomass plans when you were a minister?
Yeah,
yourself.
Look, when I went into the department, there was no plan there. And the plan was to gently wind these down along the timeline that's there at present. And I didn't agree with that. And I said, look, there has to be a fair transition over a period of time. And, you know, the companies were dragged kicking and screaming to that, but they did proceed on that basis.
You declared yourself to be probably the Dáil single biggest supporter of biomass at
yes.
the time.
Yeah, and I was and still am. And I still believe that there is an opportunity there, if the willingness is there, to at least see one of those two power plants be used for biomass.
Just Eden Derry announced in recent weeks, the Board of Mona have announced that they will be going in for planning permission on what is a dual powered generator presently at peat and biomass is going full biomass application to try and to make, increase its life beyond 2024 to 2030. And that's welcomed, and I would expect that it would receive a favourable reaction from on board Panola because 80%...
That was expected before and it did not
come. Well, 80% of it will be sourced locally, which wasn't the case with the application that was made by Diesel.
That was never the intention of that application. It was to be sourced locally.
Yeah. Okay, I just want to let Grainne in just for one moment before we move on. Grainne, you've been listening to... Have you been following this debate about the Midlands?
I think it's very... I just want to bring it back out to look at the Midlands in general. You know, Barry mentioned that there's a plan for, you know, to be put in place by the government. I think, and you know, I've spoken to farmers, particularly around the Brexit debate, about the dairy herd in particular, and they, you know, as was said, people are open to change, but I think the order in which things happen is wrong from what we've seen so far. So we need to have the alternatives in place before places shut down, because it leads to chaos in the situations like we have now. The way things seem to operate at the moment is that the jobs disappear and there's not an alternative immediately in place instead of the other way around.
Yeah,
it would
that's
work
made
much
all
better.
Our jobs harder.
Oh, okay, yeah. You've got everybody nodding along with you in the studio for that.
That was the whole plan that was there, was to transition away
over
from
time,
heat to biomass over a 10-year period and to create jobs with domestically sourced biomass. And it is specifically written into the terms and conditions of Borden and Mona that it had to source, it had to have preference for domestically sourced biomass. Just come back to one point.
No, we can't come back to it. We'll
but no,
on
the,
re-
on the retro, retrofit, like there is a semi-state company that's leading that now, and that's on post using private money and is actually doing the and coordinating the retrofitting around the country. And we should be accessing European Investment Bank funding for that much cheaper to encourage people to retrofit their homes.
The one thing, though, that we...
I have to move on.
The one thing,
Michael,
though, that I think
on.
We should...
How quickly can you say this?
The 750 houses, I think, being earmarked for retrofit. Anybody from anywhere can tender for that. It's not a person from the Midlands that lost their job. And I think we have to make sure that these people have jobs, not letting someone from Cork or Dublin or wherever go down and be retrofitting the house while they look on watching them.
Yeah, but it's to engender a new spirit of innovation and enterprise in the region that creates its own new jobs. And that's no disrespect to those that are in those jobs that are losing them presently. The age profile is quite high, and there has to be training to help and assist them to get medium-term or short-term.
I'm sorry, Dennis. I'm going to have to leave it there, but we will no doubt come back to this again. It's not a story that's going to go away from us. But now it's time that we have decided to call the late diversion. This is where we take a breather from the debate and delve a little deeper into political moments and matters. We'll be looking at pivotal moments at gaffes and at the glory. And if you've one of these that you'd like to hear more about, you can text us on 51551. But for tonight, earlier, Jack Murray, CEO of Media HQ, dropped into studio to take us back to a January night in another RTE studio in 1999.
Yes, Katie, as you said yourself, the biggest political changes often happen in a moment. Sometimes it can be an offhand remark, an overconfident boast. And as the saying goes, this one happened on the Late Late Show. It was a Friday night, the 15th of January in 1999. And Pádraig Flynn was one of the guests. He was EU Commissioner at the time. And he'd had a very busy week. The EU Commission, where he was Ireland's Commissioner at the time, had just survived a motion of censure from the Parliament. And Flynn, by his nature, is a very gregarious person. And on the night in question, he was in especially great form. And the story goes that his original interview was scheduled to be at the end of the programme. And he was in such high form in the green room that the production team thought, this man is cooked, he's good to go, we need to get him out live on air as soon as possible. So he came out on air with the late, great Gay Byrne. And just moments into the interview, he would create a pivotal political moment that would change the direction of Irish politics. But it's worth reflecting, I suppose, on what led to that moment.
Yeah, because, of course, there is a long backstory to this. It's about planning.
Yeah, in one word, it's planning. And it's easy to forget now, in the days that we live now, but the late 1990s was a very cathartic time in Irish politics. We had come to the point where the corruption of the 1980s, we wanted to lance the boil of that. And there was a series of tribunals. We had the McCracken Tribunal. It reported in really quick time, and that kind of put paid to Charlie Haughey. It was so successful then, the Moriarty Tribunal came after that. Now, that would take a good while longer. And I suppose the nub of the matter here was that, on the planning thing, is that for a number of decades there'd been serious questions and rumours around corruption in Dublin County Council. Strange decisions, land rezonings and a dysfunctional system that people thought you needed to kind of oil it liberally to get a result out of it. And there was no hard evidence. And then two men stood up, two barristers, in July 1995, Michael Smith and Colin McGeochick, offered £10,000 as a reward for information to lead to a conviction for planning corruption. And their search piqued the attention of a man called James Gogarty. And James Gogarty was a former disgruntled construction employee, and he had plenty of secrets. His evidence was potentially explosive. He named former Fianna Fáil cabinet minister Ray Burke, and Ray Burke resigned, and Taoiseach Bertie Ahern, his hand was forced. And a new tribunal, as if we didn't have enough tribunals, another tribunal came along. And this one was called the Flood Tribunal, and it later became the Mahon Tribunal. And its job was very simple: follow the rezoning money. Now, this is where it gets really interesting, Katie. As the investigators prepared for the tribunal, they discovered a very interesting Garda report from the early 1990s that never amounted to anything. And it was filed by a Sligo-born property developer who was living in London, and his name, Tom Gilmartin. And remember that name. He'd been involved in the early stages of what turned out to be Liffey Valley, and at that stage it was the largest shopping centre in Ireland. And the tribunal contacted Gilmartin, but he was so traumatised by the experience and he was reluctant, and he said he had such a bad time coming to Ireland that he wouldn't come back.
Okay, so that's the background. And I can tell you, I spent a great many years of my life incarcerated in Dublin Castle at both the Moriarty and the Flood and the Mahon tribunals. So this is very close to my heart. Tell our listeners how this then relates to that night on the Late Late Show.
So let's go back to January the 15th, and it was a cold January night, and Páraic Flynn arrived out onto the set with Gay Byrne. And if you can imagine it now, every inch the European power broker, the power suit, the darkened hair, larger than life character, and Gay Byrne set the mood from the very start, talking about the heave that had happened earlier that week against the Commission. Here's how it started.
Yes, you're laughing now, P, but narrow escape yesterday. Did you get the shock of your life? You were nearly gone, you and the rest of the gang.
Survived it once again.
Survived it once again. You're used to survival.
The funny line on that, Katie, is survived it once again. He had survived that, but he didn't know what was about to come in a moment for him. And Gay Byrne was so good in these moments. He was the ringmaster par excellence. He'd set the agenda on the Late Late Show for 37 years, and this was actually his last season. He was a couple of months from retirement, and Gay Byrne, in only the best way that he could, got to work on Páraic Flynn. He built him up, and it's a bit, when you look back on it, it's a bit like putting the wind underneath Icarus's wings.
Okay, let's just have a listen to that part of the interview.
You have immense power, P. You have immense power. Do you love it?
Yes.
You love the power.
Well, I don't know
there.
What's the sense of power, but you get the opportunity at this level of doing something substantial and leaving something behind you. There are two types of politicians, really. Front runners and safe people. The safe people keep everything nice and even. So you've got to get the balance right. Now, the front runners, they're motivators. But, of course, they take terrible risks because they identify problems and they try and put the solutions in place as against the ideological.
And you're a front runner.
You've said it.
You've got to love it, don't you? You can kind of see that the Titanic is about to hit an iceberg and you're just wondering. And I remember that night, I was about to go out on that Friday night, and the minute it started, I pulled up a chair and I thought, something's going to happen here. And the interview had so many great moments. It was really the gift that kept giving. And I have to tell you, it produced one of my favourite interview moments of all time, bar none. One of the best ever memes.
Okay, let's have a listen to one of your favourite moments of all time.
I get, with expenses, $140,000 a year, and I pay 30.3% tax on that, so it's about a net $100,000. And out of that $100,000, I run a home in Dublin, Castlebar, and Brussels. I want to tell you something. Try it sometime when you have a couple of cars and three houses and three homes and a few housekeepers.
Isn't it just fantastic? And do you know what? It's one of those ones where it still comes up in kind of in conversations where somebody will suggest something outlandish and somebody else will say, try it sometime when you have a couple of this or you have a couple of that. And it's so good. And there's so many of those moments in this interview. And what Gay Byrne did so expertly was he made Páraic Flynn feel at his ease. And when he was feeling at his most comfortable, Byrne was like a chess grandmaster. He made his significant move. Now, Tom Gilmartin, remember him? We talked about him earlier on. Well, Páraic Flynn was one of those people that he gave money to, and Gay asked him about it. Now, Flynn initially batted him off and was ready for the approach by Gay Byrne. But, you know, our front runner, our European commissioner, he just couldn't dodge the excitement. This is what happened.
But you know Gilmartin.
Oh, yeah.
You know Tom Gilmartin.
Yeah. I haven't seen him now for some years.
I
met him. He's a Sligo man who went to England, made a lot of money, came back, wanted to do a lot of business in Ireland. Didn't work out for him. He's not well. His wife isn't well. And he's out of sorts.
So that was the moment, Jack.
Yeah. And I love that line as well. Like the euphemism, he was out of sorts. And, you know, he kind of summed it up. What Páraic Flynn didn't realise was in that moment, it was the pivotal moment. He changed the course of Irish politics. Tom Gilmartin was out of sorts, all right, because he was listening to the interview. And he was at home with his wife in Luton, and he was listening to it on Tara TV. And to say he was seething, it was an understatement. He was so angry, Katie, at how Flynn had demeaned him and how he'd belittled his wife. His wife suffered from multiple sclerosis and was paralysed in a wheelchair. And he decided, he vowed that day that he was going to go to do everything he could to get back at Pádraig Flynn and that he was going to get to him really quickly. And by the end of the week, he was telling the Sunday papers that he was coming back and he was going to testify at the tribunal. And he said it was one of those sliding door moments that if Pádraig Flynn had stuck to his text and said, I'm not going to say anything about the tribunal, it probably wouldn't have happened. And it shows you how the arrogance at play, and it also shows the mastery of Gay Byrne. It's worth remembering about this pivotal moment that Pádraig Flynn's career ended in September of 1999, 9 months after this. The entire European Commission had to resign over allegations of malpractice. He never held another political office after that. And Tom Gilmartin's evidence proved pivotal at the tribunal. It caused huge problems for Bertie Ahern, people like the late Liam Lawler, George Redmond, former Dublin County Council official, and Frank Dunlop. I think before we leave the story, one of the things that fascinates me about this moment is the bravery of Tom Gilmartin and the pressure that he came late in his life. And he passed away in November of 2013. And in some regards, that after that moment with Pádraig Flynn, he became the person that they couldn't silence. And his son, Tom Jr., delivered the eulogy at the funeral. And I think it's a fitting kind of end to the story. And let me just quote from the eulogy. Ireland owes my father a debt of gratitude for doing what he has done. He's owed an apology by the state and by certain parts of the political media and the establishment for what was done to him. And I think the interesting thing from Tom Gilmartin's point of view was he could have backed down and his life would have been simpler. And if it wasn't for the steps that he took, at great personal cost to him, because the tribunal thing took years, we wouldn't have found out any of that. And it definitely changed how politics operates in this country.
Did he ever get that apology, Tom Gilmartin?
Not that I'm aware of. I do think that the flow of what happened through the tribunal would have been very satisfying, very satisfactory for him. But you could imagine that it all took so long, the personal toll, and he was in his later years, and it wasn't exactly a tranquil time either for his final years.
Indeed not. Jack Murray, unbelievable moment. I think anyone who's interested in politics country will remember it. But if they didn't, it certainly came back to life there with those clips. Many thanks. That's Jack Murray there, CEO of Media HQ. And that was Jack speaking to us just before we came to air. And just before we go to a break, I want to bring you a tweet from Ursula von der Leyen's Twitter account. She says, we had a lively and interesting discussion on the state of play across the list of outstanding issues. We gained a clear understanding of each other's positions. They remain far apart. We agreed that the teams should immediately reconvene to try to resolve these essential issues. We will come to a decision by the end of the weekend. OK, we'll take a break.
The Late Debate with Katie Hannon on RTE Radio 1.
And you're welcome back. Now, earlier today, the Dáil was told that the Minister for Health, Stephen Donnelly, will investigate claims that student nurses and midwives are being asked to work when they shouldn't be. A review is underway of allowances for all student nurses and for the payment of final year students. The Taoiseach told the Dáil that allowances would increase when the review is completed by the end of the year. And of course, this issue has gained more traction since the Cabinet approved pay increases for judges and retired politicians, as well as allowances for whips on Tuesday. Barry Cowan, you voted against the People Before Profit motion on, I think it was this night week, last week, to pay student nurses. Obviously, you voted against that motion. So why?
Well, it was an oversimplification of a complex matter and very political opportunism on the part of People Before Profit. And I suppose our response was one which sought to assure that sector that there was a process underway and that there would be a result from that and recommendations would emanate from it. In hindsight, one should have recognised the thrust of the motion and agreed with it, the same as you had a motion this week before the House in relation to mental health and the government responded positively to that.
Yeah,
motion.
Do you think it was a mistake how you handled it last week?
I personally think it was a mistake on the part of the government in the way in which they responded to it, because it was too easy for the opposition to put that motion.
But I accept
the party whip system because I'm a member of a political democratic party, and I think, you know, we prioritise and provide a programme for government that seeks to represent all sectors across a wide range of society. It's easy for opposition at a time like this to take advantage of an opportunity and use it in an age when the soundbite works, in an age when the photograph works, in an age when the tweet works. But that's not to take away from the genuine...
If it was
the genuine,
mistake,
the genuine failings of the system to recognise the situation as it
can
is
you retrieve,
presently.
Can you retrieve the situation
Of
now?
Course you can retrieve the situation. And, you know, the point that you made in relation to what Stephen Donnelly said is quite correct too. If it is a fact that many hospitals are taking advantage of student nurses and abusing them and not abiding by the rules and regulations associated with a programme and a degree course that was initiated with the consent and agreement of the INMO back in 1998, well, it has to be addressed.
But sure, that agreement, no, sorry to cut across,
but that agreement was agreed.
It was never envisaged a situation where you would have student nurses working in wards in a middle of a global pandemic when huge numbers of nurses were out on sick leave, were self-isolating, and those nurses were then obviously expected to step in and did their piece.
It was a marvellous effort, as we all know, on the part of frontline staff across the public service, and particularly in the health service, and particularly those members of staff that put themselves in harm's way for the betterment of those that they wished to protect. And student nurses answered the call. I think 50% of student nurses responded positively to the call and were recompensed initially at a rate of the healthcare assistance pay. Now, you know, as the pandemic dissipated, that payment was withdrawn. That's something that should be looked at again, if it is that people are doing their what was patriotic duty, I would say, that they have to be rewarded along the same lines again. But apart from that, Katie, this pandemic will pass, thankfully, and the health service, you know, needs to look at the way in which it trains its nurses, the way in which that degree course works, the way in which the allowance of 60 euros is obviously not sufficient to meet the demands
and not received by many nurses, not exactly nurses that I've spoken to.
And that's why a review is underway and was underway before that motion was put before the Dáil. And notwithstanding the mistake on the part of the government to respond in the way in which it did to that motion, it has a duty and an obligation to finalise that review that is taking place and to make recommendations. And I'll take at face value at this stage the commitment that the Taoiseach has made, and that is that that will lead to an increase in allowances. And of course it should lead to an increase in allowance. And I want to recognise too, there is an acknowledgement and appreciation on the part of the wider society and the wider public service to have a particular acknowledgement and appreciation and a reward for those that work in the health service, that we've seen at first hand during what has been the worst pandemic imaginable, the great efforts that was made by them in staving off what could have been an awful lot worse for this country.
Okay, very quickly, Dennis.
Yeah, I think it was a mistake, and I think the government need to look at it again. But I think there's a bigger issue here, and it came across in the discussion with Richard Boyd-Barrett and the Taoiseach today, where Richard Boyd-Barrett was giving examples of frontline nurses who were working in conditions that they shouldn't be working in. And the Taoiseach said, look, provide us with the evidence in relation to that. And of course, those staff are afraid. First of all, they're only staff in training. But there is a huge culture within the HSE in particular that wasn't there in the old health board system, where people are afraid to come forward, are afraid to talk even to public representatives and provide them with the facts and information in relation to it. And there's a far broader cultural issue that needs to be addressed within the HSE.
I've only 30 seconds.
Yeah, I think the first thing that people need to know, and I know that the likes of Barry and them got a lot, and I voted for the nursing, for the motion, but a motion isn't going to solve anything, it's not law. That's the first thing I think people need to know. I've seen about 50 motions since I came into the Dáil, and they made no difference, to be quite frank about it. I think in the line of nursing, I have said it for a number of years, if we want to keep nurses in this country, We have first of all got to pay the college fees. We should be, one time ago, there was the nurses' houses that they had where they were training in all the places. Yeah. And on top of that, we need to make sure there's accommodation, that they get proper training, or else we're going down a road of an apprentice nurse that you paid them from day one like any other apprentice.
Okay.
And that's what they have to decide.
Okay.
But let me say one last thing. If we go down the road of paying the college, making sure they have accommodation, looking after them well, then I think there should be a buy-in and a contract that they stay in this country, providing we have work for them.
Okay, we have to take that break.
The Late Debate with Katie Hannan on RTE Radio 1.
And that's all we have time for tonight. The programme was produced by Caroline Dalton. Research was by Andrew Fleming. The broadcast coordinator is Elaine Conlon. And Damien Channels was on sound. And now it's over to Colin Murray on Late Day.